but Williams knew Bernice pretty well by now.
"Bernice," she said at last, "I can tell you have something on your mind."
Bernice was able to be honest with her friend.
"Ruth, it's something unprofessional and distasteful."
"Do you mean to say you've uncovered something new?"
"Oh, no, not about Pat. No, that subject's been dormant for quite some time. You can be sure it will reawaken if anything new comes up, though."
Bernice looked at Williams for a long moment.
"You don't think I'll ever find anything, do you?"
"Bernice, you know that I support you and your efforts 100%, but with that support, I must add my sincere doubts that your efforts will ever uncover anything. It was just so futile, so tragic."
Bernice shrugged.
"Well, that's why I'm trying to focus my efforts only where they'll do some good. Which brings me to the uncomfortable subject for the day. Did you know I was arrested in jail Sunday night?"
Williams was, of course, incredulous.
"Jailed? Whatever for?"
"Soliciting an undercover cop for an act of prostitution."
That brought the right response from Williams. Bernice went on to tell her as much of the indignities as she could remember.
"I can't believe it," Williams kept saying. "That's disgusting. I can't believe it."
"Well, anyway," Bernice said, bringing in the punchline, "I feel I have good cause to question Mr. Brummel's motives. Mind you, I only have theory and speculation. But I want to chase these things to their end, to see if anything really lies behind them."
"Well, I can understand that.
And what could I possibly know that would help you?" "Have you ever met Professor Julian Langstrat over in the psychology department?"
"Oh, once or twice. We shared a table at a faculty luncheon."
Bernice caught a glint of distaste in William's expression.
Something wrong with her?"
"Well, to each his own," said William, stirring her salad absent-mindedly with a fork.
"But I found her very difficult to relate to. It was next to impossible to start any coherent conversation."
"How does she carry herself? Is she forceful, retiring, assertive, obnoxious?"
"Aloof, for one thing, and I guess mysterious. Although I use that word for lack of one better, I get the impression that people are nothing but a bore to her. Her academic interests are very esoteric and metaphysical, and she seems to prefer them to bland reality."
"What kind of company does she keep?"
"I wouldn't know. I'd almost be surprised to find her consorting with anyone at all."
"So you've never seen her in the company of Alf Brummel?"
"Oh, and this must be the ultimate goal of your questions. No, never at all."
"But I guess you don't see her much anyway."
"She's not very social, so no. But listen, I really try to mind my own business, if you catch my meaning. I would definitely like to help you in any way I can to satisfy yourself concerning Pat's death, but what you're after this time is unprofessional and distasteful."
"Yes, you certainly were right on that score. But accompanied with my own advice to disengage yourself from this thing, let me, as a friend, refer you to someone who might know more. Have your pencil ready? His name is Albert Darr, and he's in the psychology department. From what I've heard, mostly from him, he rubs shoulders with Langstrat every day, doesn't like her at all, and loves to gossip. I'll even go so far as to call him for you."
Albert Darr, a baby-faced young professor with stylish clothes and a certain penchant for ladies, just happened to be in his office grading papers. He had time to talk, especially to the lovely reporter from the Clarion.
"Well, hello, hello," he said as Bernice came in the door.
"Well, hello, hello yourself," she responded. "Bernice Kruger, the friend of Ruth Williams."
He looked to and fro for an empty chair, and finally moved a pile of reference books.
"Have a seat. Pardon the mess."
He sat down on another pile of books and papers that might have had a chair under it.
"What can I do for you?"
"Well, this isn't really an official visit, Professor Darr."
"Albert."
Thank you. Albert. I'm actually here on a personal matter, but if my theories are right, it could be important in a newsworthy sense.
She paused to indicate a new paragraph and a difficult question.
Now, Ruth tells me you know Julian Langstrat.
Dar suddenly smiled broadly, leaned back in his piled-up chair, and rested his hands behind his neck. This was going to be an enjoyable subject for him, it seemed.
"Ah," he said gleefully, "so you dare to infringe on sacred ground?"
Dar looked around the room in mock suspicion, searching for imaginary eavesdroppers, then leaned forward and said in a lowered voice,
"Listen, there are certain things no one is supposed to know, not even myself."
Then he brightened up again and said,
"But our dear professor has had many an occasion to hurt and slight me, and therefore I feel indebted to her, not in the least. I'm dying to answer your questions."
Evidently, Bernice could just dive right in. This guy didn't seem to need formalities.
"Okay. To begin with," she said, readying her pen and pad, "I'm really trying to find out about Alf Brumel, the chief of police. I've been informed that he and Langstrat see a lot of each other. Can you verify that?"
"Oh, definitely."
"So, they do have something going."
"What do you mean, something?"
"You fill in the blank."
"If you mean a romantic fling," he smiled and shook his head. "Oh, dear, I don't know if you'll like this answer, but no, I don't think anything like that's going on."
"But he does see her quite regularly."
"Oh, yes, but a lot of people do. She gives consultations in her off hours. Tell me now, doesn't Brumel see her on a weekly basis?"
With ebbing spirit, Bernice answered,
"Yes, every Tuesday, on the dot."
"Well, there, you see. He goes to her for regular weekly sessions."
"But why won't he tell anybody? He's very secretive about it."
He leaned forward and lowered his voice.
"Everything Langstrat does is a deep, dark secret. The inner circle, Bernice. No one is even supposed to know about these so-called consultations. No one but the privileged, the elite, the powerful, the many special patrons that go to her. That's the way she is." "But what's she up to?"
"Mind you now," he said with a mischievous glint in his eye, "this is privileged information, and I might also caution you that it is not entirely reliable. I know very little of this from direct observation. Most of it I've just managed to pick up around the department here. Fortunately, Professor Langstrat has made enough enemies that few of the staff feel any commitment or loyalty to her."
He repositioned himself into an eye-to-eye posture.
"Bernice, Professor Langstrat is... how should I say it? Not a ground-level person. Her areas of study go beyond anything the rest of us have had any desire to tamper with. The source, the universal mind, the ascended planes."
"I'm afraid I don't know what you're talking about."
"Oh, none of us know what she's talking about either. Some of us are very concerned. We don't know if she's very brilliant and making some real breakthroughs, or if she's somewhat deranged."
"Well, what is all this stuff, this source and this mind?"
"All right. As nearly as we can tell, she derives it from the Eastern religions, the old mystic cults and writings, things I know nothing about and don't want to know anything about. As far as I'm concerned, her studies in these areas have caused her to lose all contact with reality. As a matter of fact, I may even be mocked and maligned among my peers for saying this, but I don't see Langstrat's advances in these areas as anything other than foolish neo-pagan witchcraft. I think she's desperately confused."
Bernice now recalled to mind Marshall's strange descriptions of Langstrat.
"I've heard she does strange things to people."
"Foolishness. Sheer foolishness. I think she believes she can read my mind, control me, put spells on me, whatever. I simply dismiss it and try very hard to be elsewhere."
But does any of it have credence?
Absolutely not. The only people she can control or affect are the poor dupes in the inner circle who are stupid and gullible enough to...
The inner circle? You used that term before.
He held up his hand to caution her. No facts, no facts. I coined that title myself. All I have is a two here and a two there, which makes a very persuasive four. I've heard her admit that she counsels these people who come to her, and I've noticed that some of them are quite important. But how could a counselor with such warped ideas possibly straighten out anyone else? Then again...
Yes?
I would expect her to claim a special advantage in such a situation. Who knows? Maybe she holds seances and mind-reading sessions. Maybe she cooks slug tails and newt's eyes and serves them with breaded spider legs to evoke some answer from the supernatural. Oh, but now I'm getting facetious.
But you do see this as a possibility.
Well, not nearly as bizarre as I've described, but yes, something along those lines, in keeping with her occult interests.
And these people in the inner circle see her regularly?
As far as I know, I really have no idea how it's set up or why people even go. What on earth could they be getting out of it?
Can you give me some for instances?
Well, he thought for a moment. Of course, we've already mentioned and verified you're Mr. Brummel. Oh, and you might know of Ted Harmel. Bernice just about dropped her pen.
Ted?
Yes, the former editor of the Clarion.
I worked for him before he left and Hogan bought the paper.
The way I understand it, Mr. Harmel didn't just leave.
No, he fled, but who else?
Mrs. Pinkston, a trustee on the Board of Regents.
Ah, so it's not just men.
No, certainly not. Bernice kept writing.
Go on, go on.
Oh, dear, who else? I think Dwight Brandon.
Who's Dwight Brandon?
Dar looked at her condescendingly. He only owns the property the college is built on.
Oh.
She wrote the name down with a bold-lettered explanation. Oh, and then there's Eugene Baylor. He's general treasurer, a very influential man on the Board of Regents, I understand. It seems he's been needled just a little about what it is he and the professor do in their sessions together, but he remains self-righteous and steadfast in his convictions.
Hmm.
Ah, and there's also that reverend fellow, that,
Oliver Young?
How did you know? Bernice only smiled.
A lucky guess. Carry on.
Chapter 10 On Friday evening, Hank couldn't get the upcoming business meeting off his mind, which was probably to his advantage, considering the young lady sitting across from him in his little office corner of the house. He had asked Mary to stick closely around and act very loving and wifely. This young lady, Carmen was the only name she gave, was quite a caseload. The way she dressed and carried herself, Hank made sure that it was Mary who answered her knock at the door and let her in. But as far as Hank could tell, Carmen wasn't trying to put on a facade. She seemed real enough, just sincerely overdone. And as for her reasons for wanting counseling,
"I think," she began, "I think I'm just very lonely, and that's why I keep hearing voices."
Immediately she examined their faces for their reaction. But after their recent experiences, nothing sounded too far out to Hank and Mary. Hank asked, "What kind of voices? What kind of things do they say?" She thought for a moment, searching the ceiling with big, overly innocent blue eyes.
"What I'm experiencing is legitimate," she said. "I'm not crazy."
"No problem there," Hank said. "But tell us about these voices. When do they talk to you?"
"When I'm alone, especially. Like last night, I was lying in bed and..."
She related the words the voice spoke to her, and it could have been a perfect script for an obscene phone call. Mary didn't know what to say. This was becoming heavy. To Hank, it sounded kind of familiar, and though he felt very cautious about Carmen and her motives, he still remained open to the possibility that she was encountering some of the same demonic forces he'd been dealing with. "Carmen," he asked, "do these voices ever say who they are?" She thought for a moment.
"I think one of them was Spanish or Italian. He had an accent, and his name was Amano or Amonzo or something like that. He always spoke very soothingly and always said he wanted to make love to me."
Just then the phone rang. Mary quickly got up to answer it. "Hurry back," said Hank. She hurried away, that was for sure. Hank was watching her go when he felt Carmen touching his hand.
"You don't think I'm crazy, do you?"
she asked with pleading eyes. Hank withdrew his hand to scratch a non-existent itch.
"No, Carmen, I'm not... I don't.
But I do want to know where these voices came from. When did you first start hearing them?"
"When I came to Ashton. My husband left me, and I came here to start over, but I get so lonely."
"You first started hearing them when you came to Ashton?"
"I think it was because I was lonely, and I still am lonely."
"What was it they said at first? How did they introduce themselves?"
"I was alone and lonely. I'd just moved here, and I thought I heard Jim's voice. You know, my husband."
"Go on."
"I really thought it was him. I didn't even think about how he could talk to me without being there, but I talked back, and he told me how much he missed me and how he thought it would be better this way, and he spent the rest of the night with me."
She began to shed some tears.
"It was beautiful."
Hank didn't know what to make of this.
"Incredible," was all he could say.
She looked at him with those big pleading eyes again and said through her tears,
"I knew you'd believe me. I've heard about you. They say you're a very compassionate man and very understanding."
"Depends on who you listen to," Hank thought. But then her hand was touching his again. "Time to call a recess," Hank thought. He said, trying to be comforting, sincere, and non-judgmental. "Listen, I think it's been a fruitful hour."
"Oh, yes."
"Would you like to come again next week sometime?"
"Oh, I'd love to,"
she exclaimed, as if Hank had asked her for a date.
"I've so much more to tell you."
"Well, okay, I think next Friday will be fine for me, if it's fine for you." "Oh, it was, and Hank stood up to give her the hint that the session was over for now. They hadn't covered much ground, but as far as Hank was concerned, boy, was it enough. "Now, let's both take some time to think about these things. After a week, they may be a little clearer to us. They might make more sense. Where, oh, where was Mary?" "Ah," she came back into the room.
"Oh, leaving so soon?" "It was wonderful,"
Carmen sighed, but at least she had let go of Hank's hand. Getting Carmen out the door was easier than Hank had expected. Good old Mary, what a lifesaver. Hank closed the door and leaned against it. "Phew," was all he could say.
"Hank," Mary said in a very hushed voice, "I don't think I like this."
She's a real hot one, she is.
"What do you think of what she said?"
I'll wait and see. Who was that on the phone?"
"Just wait till you hear this. It was some lady from the Clarion wanting to know if it was Alf Brummel we disfellowshipped from the church."
Hank suddenly looked like an inflatable toy that had sprung a leak. A little disappointed, Bernice walked into Marshall's office. Marshall was at his desk going over some new advertising copy for Tuesday's edition.
"So, what'd they say?" he asked her without looking up.
"Nope, it isn't Brummel, and I guess it wasn't a very tactful question. I talked to the pastor's wife, and by her tone of voice I can infer that the whole subject is very touchy."
I've heard talk at the barbershop. Some guy was saying they're going to vote the pastor out tonight.
Ah, so they do have troubles.
But totally unrelated to ours. And I'm glad. It's gone far enough.
Marshall looked again at the list of names Bernice had gotten from Albert Darr.
How am I supposed to get any work done around here with this kind of stuff hanging around unresolved? Bertie, you're getting to be a lot of trouble. You know that?
She took it as a compliment.
And have you looked over that flyer of elective courses Langstrat is teaching?
Marshall picked it up from his desk and could only shake his head incredulously.
What in blazes is all this stuff? Introduction to God and Goddess Consciousness and the craft? The divinity of man, witch, warlock, the sacred medicine wheel, how do spells and rituals work? You gotta be kidding.
Read on, boss.
Pathways to your inner light. Meet your own spiritual guides. Discover the light within. Harmonize your mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual levels of being through hypnosis and meditation.
Marshall read a little further and then exclaimed,
What? How to enjoy the present by experiencing past and future lives?
I like that one near the bottom there. In the beginning was the goddess. Langstrat, perhaps?
Why hasn't anyone heard all this before?
For some reason, it was never advertised in the school paper or in the public list of classes. Albert Darr gave me the flyer himself and said it was a somewhat exclusive pass-around item among the interested students.
And my little Sandy is sitting in this woman's class.
And in a way, so are all those people on the list.
Marshall set down the flyer and picked up the list. He shook his head again. It was all he could think of to do. Bernice added,
I guess I don't mind it too much if a bunch of dupes want to be taken in by this Langstrat, but they're all too important. Just look at that. Two of the college regents, the owner of the college land, the county comptroller, the district judge.
And young. Respected, revered, influential, community involved, Oliver Young.
Marshall let some memory tapes play in his head.
It fits. It makes sense now, all that vague, noncommittal stuff he was handing me in his office. Young's got a religion all his own. He's no hard-shell Baptist, I'll tell you that.
Religion I don't care about. Lies and cover-ups I do.
Well, he most certainly denied knowing Langstrat. I asked him directly, right to his face, and he told me he didn't know her.
Somebody's lying,
Bernice sing-songed.
But I just wish we had some more corroboration.
Yeah, we've only just met Darr.
What about Ted Harmel? How well did you know him?
Well enough, I suppose. You heard why he left.
Marshall sneered just a bit.
Brummel said there was some kind of scandal. But who can you believe these days?
Ted denied it.
Oh, everybody's saying everything, and everybody's denying everything.
Well, call him anyway. I have the number. He's living up near Windsor now. I think he's trying to be a hermit.
Marshall looked at all the advertising copy still on his desk, awaiting his time and attention.
How am I going to get any of this stuff done around here?
Hey, it's no biggie. If I could do some independent hoofing, the least you can do is give Ted a call. Do it tomorrow. Saturday, your day off. Reporter to reporter, newsman to newsman. You might hit it off with him.
Marshall sighed.
Let's have the number.
Mary finished the dinner dishes, put up the towel, and made her way through the little house to the back bedroom. There in the dark, Hank knelt beside the bed in prayer. She knelt down beside him, took his hand, and together they placed themselves in the hands of the Lord. God's will would be done this night, and they would accept it, whatever it was. Alf Brummel had a key to the church and was already there, switching on the lights and turning up the thermostat. He wasn't feeling well at all. They just better vote right this time, he kept thinking.
Outside, even though it was still a half hour before the meeting, cars began to arrive. More than were usually there on Sundays. Sam Turner, Brumell's chief cohort, drove up in his big Cadillac and helped his wife Helen from the car. He was a rancher of sorts, not a land baron, but he acted like one. Tonight he was grim and determined, as was his wife. In another car came John Coleman and his wife Patricia, a quiet couple who came to Ashton Community after leaving a large church elsewhere in town. They really liked Hank and made no effort to hide it. They knew well that Alf Brumell would not be happy to see them there. Others arrived and quickly coagulated into little clusters of similar sentiment, speaking in quick syllables and hushed tones and keeping their eyes to themselves, except for a few rubbernecking nose counters trying to foresee the final tally. Several dark shadows kept a wary eye on everything from their perch atop the church roof, their stations around the building, or their appointed posts in the sanctuary. Lucius, more nervous than ever, paced and hovered about. Baal Raphar, still wanting a very low profile, had entrusted this task to him, and for this night at least Lucius was back in his old glory. What worried Lucius the most were the other spirits standing around, the enemies of the cause, the host of heaven. They were held at bay by Lucius's forces, to be sure, but there were some new ones he had never seen before. Nearby, but not too near, Cigna and his two warriors kept watch. Upon Tal's orders, they allowed demons access to the building, but monitored the demons' activities and kept an eye out for Raphar. So far, their very presence, as well as the presence of so many other warriors, had had a taming effect on the demonic hosts. There had been no incidents, and for now that was all Tal wanted. When Lucius saw the Colemans come in the front door, he was agitated. In the past, they had never been very strong against the defeats and discouragements Lucius had ordered, and their marriage had just about dissolved. Then they aligned themselves with Praying Bush, hearing his words and becoming stronger all the time. Before long, they and others like them would be a real threat. But their arrival didn't cause Lucius as much agitation as the huge blond-haired messenger of God who accompanied them. Lucius knew for sure he'd never seen this one before. As the Colemans found a seat, Lucius swooped down and accosted this new intruder. "I've not seen you before," he said gruffly, and all the other spirits focused their attention on him and the stranger. "From where do you come?" The stranger, Kaiman of Europe, said nothing. He only riveted his eyes on those of Lucius and stood firm. "I'll have your name," Lucius demanded. The stranger said not a word. Lucius smiled slyly and nodded. "You are deaf, yes, and dumb, and as mindless as you are silent." The other demons guffawed. They loved this kind of game. "Tell me, are you a good fighter?" Silence. Lucius drew a scimitar that flashed blood red and droned metallically. On cue, all the other demons did the same. The clatter and ring of burnished blades filled the room as crimson crescents of reflected light danced about the walls. The other messengers of God were barred from intervening by an armed ring of demons as Lucius continued to toy with this one single newcomer. Lucius peered at his solid, unmoving opponent with a burning hatred that made his yellow eyes bulge and his sulphurous breath chug out through widely flared nostrils. He toyed with his sword, waved it in small circles in the stranger's face, watched for the stranger to make the slightest move. The stranger only watched him, not moving at all. With an intense cry, Lucius swept his sword across the front of the stranger, slashing his garment. Cheers and laughter came from the crowd of demons. Lucius, poised for a fight, held his sword with both hands, crouched, his wings flared. Before him stood a statue with a slashed tunic. "Fight, you listless spirit!" Lucius challenged. The stranger did not respond, and Lucius cut his face. Another cheer from the demons. "Shall I remove an ear, or two? Shall I cut out your tongue if you have one?" Lucius taunted.
"I think it's time we got started," said Alf Brumell from the pulpit.
The people in the room stopped their hushed conversations, and the place began to quiet down. Lucius leered at the stranger and motioned with his sword.
"Go stand with the other cowards."
The newcomer stepped back, then took his place with the other messengers of God behind the demonic barricade. 11 angels had managed to get into the church without raising too much ire from the demons. Triskall and Creone had already entered with Hank and Mary. They had often been seen with the pastor and his wife, so they were not paid much attention other than the usual threatening expressions and postures. Gila was there, as big and threatening as ever, but apparently no demons were the slightest bit interested in asking him any questions. A newcomer, a burly Polynesian, made his way over to Kaiman and tended the wound in Kaiman's face while Kaiman repaired the slash in his tunic. "Moda, called here from Polynesia," came the introduction. "Kaiman of Europe, welcome to our numbers." "Can you continue?" Mota asked. "I will continue," Kaiman answered, skillfully reweaving his tunic with his fingers. "Where is Tal?"
"Not here yet."
"A demon of fever tried to stop the Colemans. No doubt Tal has encountered an attack on Duster.
I don't know how he'll ward it off without making himself visible."
"He'll do it." Kaiman looked about. "I don't see the Baal Prince anywhere."
"We may never."
"And may he never see Tal." Brumel brought the meeting to order, standing behind the pulpit and looking out over the nearly 50 people who had gathered. From this vantage point, even he couldn't help but try to guess the final tally. Some of the people were definitely going to give Hank the axe, some were definitely not going to, and then there was that frustrating and unpredictable group he couldn't be sure about.
"I want to thank you all for coming tonight," he said. "This is a painful matter for us to decide. I'd always hoped that this night would never come, but we all want God's will to be done, and we want what will be best for his people. So let us open with a word of prayer and commit the rest of the evening to his care and guidance."
With that, Brumel began a very pious prayer, appealing to the Lord for grace and mercy and words to bring a tear to the driest eye. In the front corner of the sanctuary, Gilo sulked, wishing an angel could spit on a human. Triskall asked Kaiman, "Getting any strength?" Kaiman answered, "Why? Is somebody else going to pray?" Brumel finished his prayer. The roomful muttered a few amens, and then he went on with his introduction to the proceedings. "The purpose of this meeting is to openly discuss our feelings regarding Pastor Hank, to put an end once and for all to all the backbiting and murmuring that's been going on, and to end our meeting with a final vote of confidence. I would hope that we would all have the mind of the Lord in these matters. If you have something you wish to say to the group, we would ask that you limit your time to 3 minutes. I'll be letting you know when your time is up, so keep that in mind." Brumel looked at Hank and Mary. "I think it would be good to let the pastor have the first say. Afterwards, he'll leave us alone so we can talk freely." Mary squeezed Hank's hand as he got up. He went to the pulpit and stood behind it, gripping its sides. For the longest time, he couldn't say a word, but only looked into every eye of every face. He suddenly realized how much he truly loved these people, all of them. He could see the hardness in some of the faces, but he couldn't help seeing past that to the pain and bondage these people were under, deluded, led astray by sin, by greed, by bitterness and rebellion. In many other faces he could read the pain they were feeling for him. He could tell that some were silently praying for God's mercy and intervention. Hank let a quick prayer course through his thoughts as he began. "I have always counted it a privilege to stand behind this sacred desk, to preach the word and speak the truth." He surveyed their faces again for just a moment and then continued. "And even tonight I feel I cannot stray from God's commission to me and the purpose for which I have ever stood before you. I am not here to defend myself or my ministry. Jesus is my advocate,
and I rest the course of my life on his grace, guidance, and mercy. So tonight, since I'm standing behind this pulpit once again, let me share with you what I have received from God. Hank opened his Bible and read from 2 Timothy chapter 4. I solemnly charge you in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who is to judge the living and the dead, and by his appearing in his kingdom, preach the word, be ready in season and out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort, with great patience and instruction. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires, and will turn away their ears from the truth, and will turn aside to myths. But you, be sober in all things, endure hardship, do the work of an evangelist, fulfill your ministry. Hank closed his Bible, looked about the room, and spoke firmly. Let each of us apply God's word where it may apply. Tonight I will speak only for myself. I have my call from God. I just read it. Some of you, I know, have really gotten the impression that Hank Bush is obsessed with the gospel, that it's all he ever thinks about. Well, that's true. Sometimes I even wonder why I remain in such a difficult position, such an uphill effort. But for me, God's call on my life is an inescapable commission. And as Paul said, woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. I understand that sometimes the truth of God's word can become a divider, an irritation, a stone of stumbling. But that's only because it remains unchanged, uncompromising, and steadfast. And what better reason could there be to build our lives on such an immovable foundation? To violate the word of God is only to destroy ourselves, our joy, our peace, our happiness. I want to be fair with you, and so I'll be truthful in letting you know exactly what you may expect from me. I intend to love all of you no matter what. I intend to shepherd and feed you for as long as you'll have me. I will not discredit, compromise, or turn my back on what I believe the Word of God teaches. And that means that there may be times when you'll feel my shepherd's crook around your neck. Not to judge or malign you, but to help you move in the right direction, to protect you, to heal you. I intend to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, for that is my calling. I have a burden for this town. Sometimes I feel that burden so strongly I have to ask myself why. But it's still there, and I can't turn my back on it or try to deny it. Until the Lord tells me otherwise, I intend to remain in Ashton to answer that burden. If that's the kind of pastor you want, then you can let me know tonight. If you do not want that kind of pastor, well, I really need to know that, too. I love all of you. I want the very best God has to give you. And I guess that's all I have to say. Hank stepped down from the platform, took Mary's hand, and the two of them walked down the aisle to the door. Hank tried to catch the eyes of as many people as he could. Some gave looks of love and encouragement. Some looked away. Creone and Triscoll left with Hank and Mary. Lucius watched with mocking disdain. Gilo muttered to his fellows, "While the cat's away, the mice will play." "Where is Tal?" Kaiman asked again. Brumel stood before the group. "We'll now hear statements from the congregation. Just raise your hand to be recognized." "Yeah, Sam, why don't you go first?" Sam Turner stood and walked to the front of the sanctuary. "Thanks, Alf," he said. "Well, I've no doubt you all know me and my wife Helen. We've been citizens of this community for over 30 years, and we've supported this church through thick and through thin. Now, I don't have a lot to say tonight. You all know what kind of man I am.
I believe in loving one's neighbor and living a good life. I've tried to do right and be a good example of what a Christian ought to be. And I'm angry tonight. I'm angry for my friend, Lou Stanley. You may notice Lou isn't here tonight, and I'm sure I know why. Used to be he could show his face in this church and be a part of it. And we all loved him, and he loved us. And I think we all still do. But this Bush fellow, who thinks he's God's gift to this earth, thought he had a right to judge Lou and kick him out of the church. Now, friends, let me tell you one thing. Nobody kicks Lou Stanley out of anything if Lou doesn't feel like it. The very fact that Lou went along with this whole smear on his character only shows the goodness of his heart. He could have sued Bush by now, or he could have settled the matter like I've seen him settle other matters. He's not afraid of anything. But I just think Lou's so ashamed of the horrible things that have been said about him, and so hurt by what he thinks we must think of him, that he decided he'd better just stay away. Now we have this self-righteous, Bible-pounding gossip-monger to blame for these troubles. And forgive me if I sound a bit harsh, but listen, I can remember when this church was like a family. How long now since it's been that way? Look what's happened. Here we are, having a big bicker meeting, and why? Because we let Hank Bush come in here and stir us all up. Ashton used to be a peaceful town. This church used to be a peaceful church. And I say we do what's necessary to get it that way again.
Turner took his seat as a few nearby nodded their silent encouragement and approval. John Coleman was recognized next. A shy person, he was very nervous about speaking in front of everyone, but concerned enough to do it anyway.
Well, he said nervously, handling his Bible and looking at the floor a lot, I don't usually say much, and I'm scared to death to be standing up here, but I think Hank Bush is a real man of God, a good pastor, and I'd really hate to see him go. The church Pat and I came from, well, it just wasn't meeting our needs, and we were getting hungry. Hungry for the Word, for the presence of God. We thought we'd found those things here, and we were really looking forward to being involved and growing in the Lord under Hank's ministry. And I know a lot of other folks feel that way, too. As far as this stuff about Lou is concerned, that was not just Hank's doing. All of us were involved in that decision, including me. And I know Hank's not trying to hurt anybody.
As John sat down, Patricia patted his arm and said, "You did fine." John was not sure. Brummell addressed the group.
"I think it might be a good idea for us to hear what the church secretary, Gordon Mayer, has to say."
Gordon Mayer went to the front with some of the church records and minutes in his hand. He was a tense man with a tight expression and gruff voice.
"I have two items I'd like to address before this group," he said. "First of all, from the business side, you all need to be aware that the offerings have been decreasing over the past several months. But our bills have been staying steady, if not going up. In other words, we're running out of money, and I personally have no doubts why. There are differences among us we really need to get resolved, and withholding your giving is not the way to do it. If you have a gripe against the pastor, then do whatever you have to do tonight. But let's not bring the whole church down over this one man. Secondly, for whatever it's worth, let me tell you that the original pulpit committee was considering another man for the job. I was on that committee. I can assure you that they had no intention of recommending Bush for the office. I'm convinced the whole thing was a fluke, a grave mistake. We voted in the wrong man. Now we're paying for it. So, let me close with this. Sure, we've made a mistake, but I have faith in the group here, and I think we can turn the whole thing around and start doing things right for change. I say, let's do it."
And so the evening went for the better part of 2 hours, as both sides took turns in crucifying and praising Hank Bush. Nerves got raw, bottoms got numb, backs got sticky, and the opposing views became more and more vehement in their convictions. After 2 hours, a common sentiment began to mutter its way around the room. "Come on, let's have the vote."
Grimmel had taken his jacket off, loosened his tie, and rolled up his sleeves. He was gathering a pile of small squares of paper, the ballots.
"Okay, this will be by secret ballot," he said, handing the slips of paper to two quickly appointed ushers who passed them out. "Let's just keep it simple. If you want to keep the pastor, say yes. If you want to find someone else, say no."
Mota nudged Kaiman. "Will Hank have enough votes?" Kaiman only shook his head. "We're not sure."
"You mean he could lose?"
"Let us hope someone is praying."
"Where, oh, where is Tal?"
Writing a simple yes or no didn't take long, so almost immediately the ushers were passing the offering plates among the people. Gailo stood still in his corner, glaring at as many demons as would look at him. Some of the smaller, harassing spirits flitted about the sanctuary, trying to see what people were marking on their ballots, and grinning, scowling, cheering, or cursing accordingly. Gailo could envision three or four of their wiry little necks in his fists. "Someday soon, little demons. Someday soon." Brumel took charge again. "All right, in the interest of fairness, let's have representatives from the two different, viewpoints come up and do the counting." After a bit of nervous chuckling, John Coleman was selected by the yeas and Gordon Mayer by the nays to count the ballots. The two men took the offering plates full of ballots to a back pew. A flock of flapping, hissing demons converged on the scene, wanting to see the outcome. Gailo stepped out, too. It was only fair, he thought. Lucius swooped down from the ceiling in an instant and hissed, "Get back in your corner!" "I wish to see the outcome."
"Oh, don't you now?" Lucius sneered. "And what if I decide to cut you open as I did your friend?"
Something about the way Gailo answered, "Try it," may have caused Lucius to reconsider. Gailo's approach sent the little demons fluttering away like a flock of chickens. He bent over the two men to have a look. Gordon Mayer was counting first, silently, then handing the ballots to John Coleman. But he stealthily hid a few yay ballots in his palm. Gailo checked to see how closely the demons were watching, then made a stealthy move himself, touching the back of Mayer's hand. A demon saw it and struck Gailo's hand with bared talons. Gailo jerked his hand away and came infinitely close to tearing the demon to shreds, but he caught himself and honored Tal's orders. "What is your name?" Gailo wanted to know.
"Cheating,"
the demon answered. "Cheating," Gailo rehearsed as he went back to his corner. "Cheating." But Gailo's move had succeeded in foiling Mayer's effort. The ballots dropped out of Mayer's hand, and John Coleman saw them. "You dropped something there," he said very sweetly. Mayer couldn't say anything. He just handed the ballots over. The count was finished, but Mayer wanted to count again. They counted the ballots again. The count came out the same. A tie. The two reported the result to Brumel, who told the congregation, which moaned quietly. Alf Brumel could feel his hands getting very damp. He tried drying them on his handkerchief.
"Well, listen," he said. "There may not be much chance that any of you will reconsider, but I'm sure none of us wants to prolong this thing past tonight. I tell you what, why don't we take a short break and give some of you a chance to get up, stretch, use the restroom? Then we'll regather and vote again."
As Brumel spoke, the two demons posted around the church saw something very unsettling. Just about a block up the street were two old women, hobbling toward the church. One walked with the assistance of a cane and a helping hand from her friend. She did not look well at all, but her jaw was set and her eyes bright and determined. Her cane clacked out a syncopated rhythm with her footsteps. Her friend, in better health and stronger, kept up with her, holding her arm to support her and talking gently to her.
"The one with the cane is Duster," said one demon.
"What went wrong?"
the other wondered.
"I thought she'd been taken care of."
"Well, she's ill all right, but she's come anyway."
"And who is the old woman with her?"
"Edith Duster has many friends. We should have known.
The two ladies made their way up the church steps, each step a major task in itself. First one foot, then the other, then the cane placed on the next step until they were finally up to the front door.
There, look at that now,
cackled the stronger one.
I knew you could do it. The Lord's gotten you this far. He'll take care of you the rest of the way. What Edith Duster needs is a stroke,
murmured a sickness demon, drawing his sword. Perhaps it was simply luck or incredible coincidence, but just as the demon lunged forward with great speed to slash at the arteries in Edith Duster's brain, the other woman moved to open the door and stepped right in the way. The tip of the demon's sword struck the woman in the shoulder, which could have been concrete. The sword stopped short. Sickness did not, but catapulted over the two women and fluttered like a fractured kite into the churchyard as Edith Duster moved inside. Sickness gathered himself up off the ground and screamed,
"The host of heaven!"
The other demon guard stared at him blankly. Brummell saw Edith Duster come in alone. He cursed silently. This would be the vote to break the tie, but she would most certainly vote for Bush. The people were gathering again. The messengers of God were elated. "Looks like Tal succeeded," said Mota. Kaiman was concerned, however. With such a heavy cover of the enemy, he most certainly had to show himself. Gilo chuckled. "Oh, I'm sure our captain was very discreet." A few of the demons were in fact wondering what had happened to Edith Duster's companion between the front door and the sanctuary. Sickness continued insisting it had been a heavenly warrior. But where was she now? Tal, captain of the host, joined Cigna and the other sentries at their concealed position.
"You had me fooled, captain," said Cigna.
"You just might attempt it yourself sometime," Tal replied. On the platform, Brummell mentally groped for a trump card. He could just see the burning eyes of Langstrat if this vote went the wrong way.
"Well," he said, "why don't we come to order now and get ready for another vote?"
The people settled in and quieted down. The yea side was more than ready.
"Now that we've prayed and talked about it, maybe some of us will feel differently about the future of the church here.
Come on, Alf, say something, but don't make a fool of yourself.
I guess I could say a few words. I haven't really shared my feelings. You know, Hank Bush is a little young."
A middle-aged plumber on the yea side piped up.
"Hey, now, if you're going to put in some negative input, we've got to have equal time for some positive."
The yeas all murmured in agreement while the nays sat in cold silence.
No, listen, Brummell stammered, his face bright red. I had no intention of trying to sway the vote. I was just...
"Let's have the vote," someone said.
"Yes, vote, and quick," Mota whispered.
Just then the door opened. Oh, no, thought Brummell. Who's coming in this time? The silence fell like a shroud of death over the whole group. Lou Stanley had just come in. He grimly nodded greeting to them all and took a seat in a back pew. He looked old. Gordon Mayer piped up, "Let's have the vote." The ushers passed out the ballots, while Brummell tried to plan a good escape route in case he had to throw up. His nerves were just about shot. He caught Lou Stanley's attention. Lou looked at him and seemed to laugh nervously.
"Make sure Lou back there gets ballot," Brummell told one of the ushers.
The usher made sure. Kaiman whispered to Gilo, "I think we're ready for any tricks Lucius might have." "Any tiebreakers, you mean?" Gilo answered.
"We may be in for a long night," said Mota.
The ballots were collected, and Lucius kept his demons tightly around each offering plate and his eyes on every heavenly warrior. Mayer and Coleman counted again as the tension in the air tightened. The demons watched. The angels watched. The people watched. Mayer and Coleman kept a close eye on each other, silently mouthing as they counted. Mayer finished counting, waiting for Coleman to finish. Coleman finished, looked at Mayer, and asked him if he wanted to count again. They counted again. Then Mayer took his pen, wrote the result on a slip of paper, and carried it up to Brummell. Mayer and Coleman took their seats as Brummell unfolded the paper. Visibly shaken, Brummell took a few moments to put on his relaxed, businesslike, public image. "Well," he began, trying to control the tone of his voice, "all right, then. The pastor has been retained." One side of the room loosened up, tittered, and smiled. The other side gathered up coats and belongings to leave.
"Alf, what was the vote?" someone wanted to know.
It doesn't say." 28-26, Gordon Mayer said accusingly, looking back toward Lou Stanley. But Lou Stanley had left.
Chapter 11 Tal, Cigna, and the other sentries could see the explosion from where they stood. With cries and wails of rage, demons scattered everywhere, erupting through the roof and sides of the church like shrapnel, and fanning out in all directions over the town. Their cries became a loud, echoing drone of savage fury that rang over the whole town like a thousand melancholy factory whistles, sirens, and horns. "They will wreak havoc tonight," said Tao. Mota, Kaiman, and Gilo were there to report. "By 2 votes," said Mota. Tao smiled and said, "Very well, then." "But Lou Stanley," Kaiman exclaimed. "Was that really Lou Stanley?" Tao caught the implication. "Yes, that was Mr. Stanley. I've been standing right here ever since I delivered Edith Duster."
"I see the spirit has been working," Gilo chuckled.
"Let's get Edith home safely and get a guard around her. Everyone to your posts. There will be angry spirits over the town tonight." That night the police were busy. Fights broke out in the local taverns, slogans were spray-painted on the courthouse, some cars were stolen and joy-ridden through the lawn and flowers in the park. Late into the night, Julian Langstrat hovered in an inescapable trance, halfway between a tormented life on earth and the licking, searing flames of hell. She lay on her bed, tumbled to the floor, clawed her way up the wall to stand on her feet, staggered about the room, and fell to the floor again. Threatening voices, monsters, flames, and blood exploded and pounded with unimaginable force in her head. She thought her skull would burst. She could feel claws tearing at her throat, creatures squirming and biting inside her, chains around her arms and legs. She could hear the voices of spirits, see their eyes and fangs, smell their sulphurous breath. The masters were angry. "Failed! Failed! Failed! Failed!" pounded in her brain and paraded before her eyes. "Brummell has failed! You have failed! He will die! You will die!" Did she really hold a knife in her hand, or was this too a vision from the higher planes? She could feel a yearning, a terribly strong impulse to be free of the torment, to break loose from the bodily shell, the prison of flesh that bound her. "Join us! Join us! Join us!" said the voices. She felt the edge of the blade and blood trickle down her finger. The telephone rang. Time froze. The bedroom registered on her retinas. The telephone rang. She was in her bedroom. There was blood on the floor. The telephone rang. The knife fell from her hands. She could hear voices, angry voices. The telephone rang. She was on her knees on the floor of her bedroom. She had cut her finger. The phone was still ringing. She called out, "Hello," but it still rang.
"I won't fail you," she said to her visitors. "Leave me. I won't fail you."
The telephone rang. Alf Brummell sat in his home listening to the phone ringing on the other end. Julian must not be home. He hung up, relieved, if only for the moment. She would not be happy about the vote. Another delay, still another delay in the plan. He knew he could not avoid her, that she would find out,
that he would be confronted and berated by the others. He flopped down on his bed and contemplated resigning. Escape. Suicide.
Saturday morning.
The sun was out, and lawnmowers called to each other across fences, hedges, and cul-de-sacs.